Hello and welcome aboard Seascapes, your maritime programme. On this week's edition, we talk to architect and author of Where Land Meets Sea, Anna Ryan from the School of Architecture at the University of Limerick. Norman Freeman on a kindly sea captain, Dick Robinson on a rescue off Bag and Bun Head, and the remarkable organisation that is the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. First, though, to the historic eventual banning of discards, which has received rather a mixed response from the organisations representing fishermen this week. Acknowledging the role that Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's Fish Fight and indeed Ireland's presidency of the EU had in this decision being reached, with a gradual implementation over the coming years, Jim Higgins, MEP, spoke to Karen Coleman in the European Parliament.
What it'll mean for fishermen is that they're not going to be penalised in terms of if they take discards ashore or if, in fact, they decide to do what you're supposed to do and that is dump them overboard. I mean, it is ridiculous that one third of the fish that are caught actually have to be dumped overboard, and it's immoral apart from being impractical and so on. So from now on, the discards can be used for basically pulped in order to provide feedstuffs for animals or whatever it may be. So it's a very, very satisfactory outcome. And I think it's another significant achievement for the Irish presidency. We're only 2 months into it. We're not even 2 months into it. And it's another significant step that during the Irish presidency we were able to arrive at a solution which basically makes absolute sense economically in terms of not dumping fish that are basically out of our quota, not part and parcel of what we're supposed to do, but at the same time will be used in a sustainable way and economically productive as well.
Do you think a lot of this was down to Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, who was the one who started to draw attention to the fact that so many of these fish were being discarded back into the seas dead?
Absolutely. We have to give credit to him. I mean, he was the one that actually raised the issue, and it has been basically hanging round our neck and nobody seemed to have a solution to it. But during the Irish presidency, and thanks to the all-night negotiations that have gone on, we now have, at long last, we have a solution and a long-term sustainable solution. So I think it's another significant achievement for the Irish presidency.
Jim Higgins, Fine Gael MEP, talking to Karen Coleman at the European Parliament. Next this week to the RNLI, or the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, which this weekend celebrates 189 years. One man who has had a lifelong association with the lifeboats, growing up in Knightstown, is Valentia man Dick Robinson, who's to be awarded the gold badge for fundraising activities.
The institution is very fair in that most of the publicity will be about the crew and those who go to sea, and little about the people who raise funds. And it's just as simple as this. I get up every morning and I wake up and I know 23 people will not die today because of the RNLI. And the RNLI is there because somebody stands with a box and somebody puts a penny or a shilling or a pound note into it, because without money there would be nothing. So they do have a system of bronze, silver and gold badges. But you have to be around a good while to get the gold badge. So when I got the letter in January, I actually cried, because I went to sea to save people and I collected so people would be saved, and I wasn't in it and amn't in it for what I'll get out of it. But when somebody comes and says thank you, I appreciate it. When somebody comes and gives you their highest award and says thank you, I appreciate it more. So there will be a presentation in London in May and in the Barbican. So if I get over there and get a good map and can find the Barbican, I hope to have a lovely day there.
Now, your connection, of course, with the lifeboats and with the RNLI goes right back through your family. It's a very special institution, but great news to see that they're now in Poole going to be building their own vessels.
This is absolutely splendid, because millions were being paid to boatyards and everything. Now, it must be said that they had to change the charter of the RNLI. Now, the RNLI, a charter is, as the man said, strong law, and that committed them to saving lives at sea, but did not permit them to build boats or anything. But following a tremendous accident in the Thames, where a passenger boat was run down by a tug, they had to put lifeboats on the Thames, and to do that, the charter had to be changed. So the charter was actually changed to allow inland lifeboats in the river and that. So that allowed for building, and for all these activities were put into the new charter, which was brilliant. And I suppose, funnily enough, to tell how strong the charter was, you might remember there was a whole time of trading around Ireland when towns were nearly gone broke, and they had to come in and they closed down everything, and they brought in casual trading law and some other kind of trading law. Since I left the courts, it's getting a bit fuzzy. But civil servants can get a great idea that if you want to close a door, they'll bar the windows as well. So they decided they'd close everything. And it was challenged, I think it was in Enniscorthy, where the fare was granted by Royal Charter. So fares like Spancel Hill or any town that had this fare granted by Royal Charter, that could not be closed down. So you now have the situation in Ennis and in all the other towns that on the day of the fair, because it's granted under Royal Charter, the pubs can get their exemption to open at 6:30 in the morning, and despite the fact that the fair isn't happening, there's always somebody there to oblige to avail of the extra legal drinking hours. But that's how strong the charter was. Where people do something well in the parish or in any place, I think it's only right that it be recorded, because great chances are taken. But anyone that went to sea on that boat or on any other boat, they didn't have to be there. They walked in there and no matter what the weather was, picked up the life jacket and said, I'll go. And I think there is something spiritual about that, because as this has changed, and I've watched the change, you now have people that were never in a boat. And because technology makes it possible, and because the RNLI can train them, you can take people. I will cite one name, Pauline Dunleavy in Kilrush. She's a helmsman, senior helmsman on the boat there. Pauline joined the lifeboat to be a fundraiser. Had never been in a boat in her life, and went on the crew and is now helmsperson. But that's happening all over the place. People with no maritime background, they can be trained, they can be shown the technology, but it is a spiritual thing that makes them come forward and say, I'll go, because there is a risk. And anyone that goes onto a lifeboat and thinks they're infallible because they have a yellow jacket on them, stay at home, you're a liability. It's safe as long as you remember that it's dangerous. But the day you forget that, you're goosed.
Goosed indeed. Dick has this story, which is in the current edition of Compass, about a close call at Bag and Bun Head.
A gale was blowing from the south-southwest with a very heavy sea off the southeast coast. Just before 5:30 p.m. on the 13th of December 1941, the coast watcher at Hook Point advised the Dunmore East Station that a vessel was off the Hook Lighthouse burning flares. The Honorary Secretary asked a steamer near the Hook Point by Morse code if she could see any vessel in distress. She had not seen any. The lifeboat was not launched. At 9:15, hearing that the vessel was still there, the lifeboat Annie Blandsmith was launched from Dunmore East and searched for hours to no avail. Kilmore Quay Station had received confirmed messages from the life-saving service that a ship was in distress 4.5 miles southeast of the Hook. Seas were so violent that it was impossible to launch the lifeboat. At first light, the lifeboat Anne Isabella Pymont launched. Dunmore East lifeboat was also launched. Both lifeboats found the casualty at the same time, a mile south of Bag and Bun Head. She was the Admiralty trawler Moray. The tug Empire Ned was standing by. The Dunmore East lifeboat returned to station. The trawler had weighed her anchor and was trying to unshackle the wire from it to pass to the tug. The tug failed twice to get a heaving line on board. The Kilmore Quay lifeboat passed the line. After 20 minutes, the line parted. Again, the lifeboat got a line on board the trawler, but it fouled the tug's propeller. This got the tug into dangerous water. The lifeboat coxswain warned the trawler and put the second coxswain on board because of his local knowledge. Finally, the trawler unshackled the wire, the lifeboat passed it across, and the tug began to tow. The trawler was dangerously close to the rocks. The towing started in the nick of time. The lifeboat stood by until both vessels were clear of Bag and Bun Head, and that had been a narrow shave. The institution awarded its thanks on vellum to coxswain William Blake of Kilmore Quay Lifeboat.
Dick Robinson and that rescue by the Annie Blanche Smith in 1941 off Bag and Bun Head. The latest edition of Subsea, Ireland's diving magazine, has just been published and features items on cave diving in France, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group research vessel Celtic Mist, Grand Canyons of the Bering Sea, and underwater wheelchair diving. Also, there's a spotlight on Sheephaven Sub-Aqua Club. This is the 50th year of the Irish Underwater Council, and their annual conference takes place this weekend in Athlone, hosted by Athlone Sub Aqua Club for the third time, and the location this year is the splendid Hudson Bay Hotel. The fifth and final Atlantic Forum workshop, which we mentioned on the programme last Friday night, will take place in University College Cork on next Monday and Tuesday. The workshop will focus on research and innovation driving the EU Atlantic strategy. Next here on Seascapes to the School of Architecture at the University of Limerick, where Seascapes earlier this week met up with Anna Ryan, author of Where Land Meets Sea, Coastal Explorations of Landscape, Representation and Spatial Experience. Anna explained where her connection and love for the sea originated.
The easiest place to start in terms of where the interest arose is where I am from and where I grew up, which is Dalkey in County Dublin. The family home is up on a hill, an ordinary house in an extraordinary place, I think, overlooking the whole of Dublin Bay. And then I went to school in Loretto Dalkey, which is right down on the rocks. So I think spending that time with the salt against the windows and the time basically just watching the sea all of the time. And then summer holidays to Quilty in County Clare as a child, and then to Oysterhaven and to all different parts of Ireland, from Donegal and Achill and down various parts of the coast. So I think I got to know the sea very well as a child and teenager. When we started going to Oysterhaven on holidays, I took up windsurfing in particular. I did a bit of sailing before that. So windsurfing has become a huge passion, and that has brought me to many parts of other parts of the Irish coast and then abroad. So that has remained. I think there is a kind of an incredible feeling when you're windsurfing, of being on the sea, and it just being a sort of an individual pursuit in relation to sort of the big presence of the sea. So certainly that love is behind all of this, for sure.
So would that be a clue to why you went to Maharis in terms of the book? Because I straight away thought, why Maharis?
Yeah, it would, absolutely. Yeah, I think it was around, I was 18 or 19 when I first went to the Maharis windsurfing, and then used to go there with friends during the summer times from college. And I suppose where the interest in the book or this research started, it began as a master's study in UCC in the Department of Geography, supervised by Dr. Dennis Lenehan and Professor Robert Devoy. And it sort of expanded into a PhD and then has become a book. So that's the journey of this piece. And so in terms of thinking about places where I wanted to locate myself, I wanted to explore sort of people's spatial awarenesses, and the coast was particularly important in this, because I think it's a place where you kind of become more aware of your physical environs and surroundings, I think, because things are maybe more elemental or reduced to a certain extent. It literally began from my physical feeling in the Maharis, on the Maharis, out the Maharis, and also out on the South Wall in Dublin, where normally when you think of the coast, you think of two edges meeting, the sea meeting the land along an edge, whereas in both these places, Maharis and the South Wall, it's very different. You're actually sort of out in the centre. You move out away from the mountains of the Dingle Peninsula, and you move out away from the city, and you're right sort of encircled and surrounded. So it's almost like you're being let out into the sea. So I think that physical feeling is what started it, and then sort of a deeper exploration then started to involve other people, and the much bigger project, basically. So an intuitive beginning, anyway. Turning your back to sea, I think, is our sort of our cultural original relationship with the sea, I suppose, from a sense of recognising its power and sort of a survival relationship with it. But then I think certainly in more recent decades we've dramatically reversed that, and now sort of facing the sea has sort of marketable and monetary significance, and I think that's made a big impact on sort of the development of the coast around in Ireland. Even if we are very sensitive and sensible about understanding how we might as physical beings move in a coastal area or along by the sea, or and understand ourselves very carefully within that, nonetheless, when it comes to actually understanding that sort of line between land and sea, we do mark it as a line and try and protect and defend it, and county councils keep imposing alternative materials within a zone that they maybe are foreign. And I think part of sort of arriving at this and involving so many people in this piece of work and different positions allows you to realise sort of the breadth of understanding that we have, but we just sort of don't maybe take full cognizance of that in our decision making. I think sort of the education and aesthetic education or visual appreciation isn't necessarily part of the education of a planner. So it's something that maybe is part of other education, such as that as an architect and the kind of work we'd be doing here in UL with students. So it is, yeah, it certainly is a question. But I think everybody has an opinion about how something looks and what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate in a certain kind of a place. But certainly sort of the idea of coastal defences is something that's maybe slightly different and it becomes something functional and something just inserted and not really considered, in my opinion anyway. Yeah, and I think that sort of sense of a community that has a very long-standing relationship with this place is incredibly sort of overwhelming and powerful in Maharees, and something that I really appreciate and enjoy about the place, that there are these families that have such long sort of relationships with the sea and with the land, with seaweed fertilising the land, and with the kirks and with the fishing and with the potatoes and the carrots. Something that is also very interesting about that area is sort of they're embracing our relationship with another community that's arrived, people that might have arrived to move there for a short length of time and now are there over a decade, and you know, becoming very intrinsically part of the community. And then, as you say, the holidaymakers and that sort of seasonal fluctuation of people. But it's a place that seems to absorb that in a particular kind of way. Certainly there are issues in terms of very strongly felt ones in terms of the overconstruction of holiday homes that are left vacant throughout all the sort of off-season holiday times, and that's something that is a great pity. And then people in the locale wishing to build their own houses then are having difficulties. So there's certainly a tension there, and a very understandable one. But I think I think it's a place that kind of can absorb a breath of people, and it's very enjoyable for that.
Now, one of the challenges facing you, I suppose, particularly when you take somewhere like South Wall in Dublin, is when you were getting your research participants involved, is how do you track them down? You probably have to do what I do with what I do in the programme, is kind of doorstep people. And then, I suppose, through a series of questions, you can eliminate the fact that, well, you can basically decide on the fact that these people are enthusiastic about the subject matter or whatever, and then move it on from there.
Well, in trying to sort of access an idea of spatial sensibilities, or sort of how people might respond, or their bodily knowledge, or sort of knowledge about a place by moving through it. So on South Wall, I literally walked up to people that were walking along the South Wall, assuming they, you know, were there for a particular reason, or fishing or swimming. And asked them, would they take a disposable camera, and this small note that said, please use the camera to explore why you come here. And something similar on Maharees, though I was suggested by some of the people that I knew around the place, or I've met people in pubs, or sometimes on the beach, or sometimes in the roads. But in the South Wall, certainly it was very much cold calling, and people responded in the minute, and it was an incredible experience. And then people would send you the disposable camera, I developed it, sent them back the photographs, and met to discuss the photographs. So it wasn't kind of an interview. I wasn't specifically asking specific questions. It was more like a sort of an open discussion, or a facilitation of a discussion. And the photographs were the prompts towards that. And people had started to think out their responses to the place, and why they appreciated it so much. And it was very humbling, I think, the response that I got. And that was kind of, you know, a major aspect, going beyond myself and going to sort of starting with a intuitive starting point, and then suddenly involving over 60 people in this was really great. It is something that we might forget, or sometimes further back from the seed, that we are an island. And like living in Limerick here, for example, I feel I'm far from the sea, whereas the presence of sort of the River Shannon and its tidal nature and its expanse reminds me of the fact that, you know, we're just, or the seagulls arriving in, that, you know, I am on the coast, as a certain sense, a different kind of coast than I might, you know, have, you know, otherwise lived along. But yeah, I think the sense of ourselves as islanders is something that we could work on, I think. And
particularly when you see, I'm thinking, when I was even asking that question, the vastness of the estuary, the Shannon estuary, and the fact that Foynes is such a commanding port, but yet you have to take a detour off the main road to get as far as Foynes, or you go to somewhere like Scattery Island, which is really very redolent of those people who inhabited the island all those years ago. And it's wonderful to see old craft been built in sheds and places like that, and I'm thinking of the wonderful hooker that was built down in Querin near Loophead. People who are building these boats, putting them in the water, and then we're getting a sense of the fact that there is life out on those waters.
I've heard recently of a group within Limerick reconstructing a particular boat suitable for the Shannon and navigating the Shannon. I think those kind of activities with young people sort of in a city location are very important because it reminds people of a heritage and encourages people to use the water in multiple kinds of ways.
So what conclusions did you draw when you had completed Where Land Meets Sea, Anna?
I think probably what we were speaking about earlier in relation to this notion that we have a sense that we need to, in some kind of ways, or one way of our acting is defending ourselves against the sea, whereas in acknowledging a kind of a fluidity between how we actually sort of on an individual level relate to our coastal surroundings, we could maybe respond more from an emotional and a social perspective in terms of understanding what we might do with our physical environments, because I suppose in how we present those things to ourselves, a line drawn on a map describing an exact edge isn't really how we experience the coastal edge as we when we're there or when we launch a boat or whatever it is that we do along that edge. So I think taking more cognizance of us as moving individual human beings and collectively together, how that might help our decision making.
Anna Ryan of the School of Architecture at the University of Limerick. And you can find out more detail on the Seascapes webpage and on this website, www.ashgate.com. Where Land Meets Sea, Coastal Explorations of Landscape, Representation and Spatial Experience is published by Ashgate Publishing. Finally on Seascapes this week, Norman Freeman, author of Sea Spray and Whiskey and former radio officer, has this tale of a kindly captain.
The captain of our deck passenger ship that plied between Bombay and East Africa was far from popular with his officers. He had a peevish air about him. He spoke in a slow, dry, upper-class English accent. He had a whining way of complaining to the mate or reminding the second mate to keep the charts up to date. His white tropical uniform shorts and shirt emphasized his fatness. His knees and arms were a boiled red colour from a lifetime spent sailing around the Indian Ocean. My boss, the chief radio officer, hated him. The chief spent the evenings in the first-class bar, knocking back gin and keeping an eye out for any promising women passengers. On one occasion, his judgment clouded by alcohol, he had thrust his hand up the skirt of a seasoned English lady. She was outraged, complained to the captain. He severely rebuked the chief and made him apologise to her. The chief warned me in his sharp Belfast accent, "Don't give him any excuse to criticise us, do you understand?" Actually, the captain had never acknowledged my presence any of the times I brought the weather forecast up to the chart room. He wasn't given to friendly greetings, especially to a trainee radio officer on his first trip. Then, on our voyage back, about 3 days out from Bombay, I went on the night watch and immediately heard Bombay radio calling us with a telegram. Aware of my deficiencies in Morse code, I hurried round to the chief's cabin. He was fast asleep, lying in his underpants on his settee. An empty gin bottle sat on the low table. I was afraid to wake him. I decided to go ahead, called Bombay and copied down the telegram. It was for the captain. I was uneasy when I found the text was in five-letter commercial code. However, I put it in an envelope and left it in the chart room. Next morning there was a fuss. The captain was mystified by a group of letters that decoded as "arrival at 12 tons or thereabouts." The chief was called up to the captain's quarters. When he came down, he was furious with me. With his mouth tight and his nail-bitten fingers hammering on the Morse key, he called Bombay and had them repeat the telegram. It turned out that I had got one letter wrong. I felt a bit downcast. It didn't help that the words "arrival at 12 tons or thereabouts" became a source of amusement among the deck officers. Then, when we were almost within sight of the Indian coast, I was sitting in the radio room when the captain appeared at the door. There was just a faint glimmer of friendliness on his red face. In his weary tones, he said, "Look, Sparks, this is all new to you. We all make mistakes. Don't worry about it." Before I could respond, he was gone. Next morning, as we were entering Bombay Harbour, there was a commotion outside the radio room. The chief and I saw Dr. Gupta hurrying up the companionway to the bridge. Then we heard one of the Goan stewards saying, "Captain Saab, a heart attack is having." We telegrammed the shipping agents, telling them to have an ambulance and medical attendants at Ballard Pier when we arrived. As soon as the ship had tied up, the captain was carried down the gangway on a stretcher. The ambulance sped away. 2 days later, we heard that he would be confined to hospital. He would not be rejoining us. There wasn't much sympathy for him. "That man wore himself out winding and whinging," the chief said, with some satisfaction. I wasn't going to get into an argument with him, but to myself I said he had some good points as well.
A kindly captain recalled by Norman Freeman. Next Friday night on Seascapes, we'll have a full report from this weekend's Irish Sailing Association Awards Ball and Conference. We'll be hearing from many of the award winners. We'll be talking to scientist Mark Jessop about our colonies of magnificent puffins. All that and much more until next Friday night here on Seascapes, Tidelines and Fair Sailing.